Okay. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the With Chinese Characteristics podcast. I'm Natalie.
I'm Cherry.
And together we talk about topics with Chinese characteristics. So we have an exciting episode for you today about what is probably one of the most, if not the most, popular movie in Chinese history. Certainly the most widely seen in terms of, if you count multiple viewings. It's not Wolf Warrior 2.
No.
Which we also did an episode on. So check that out if you're interested in Wolf Warrior 2, which is probably the most popular modern Chinese film in terms of viewership. So it's called Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. And to get to what it is, we have to go back to the Cultural Revolution and even beyond that.
It's called 智取威虎山 in Chinese for our Chinese viewers.
If you Google it, it's kind of hard because there's lots of other things that have used that name. Because it's so famous, so there's like a experimental music album called Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. There's a modern Hong Kong movie, 2014.
Yeah.
But it all goes back to the Cultural Revolution, where basically Mao kind of decided that the Communist Party, the Communist Revolution had not been complete.
No.
Or that essentially it had backslid, it had regressed. And that in order, there needed to be a permanent revolution. Everybody had to constantly be revolutioning. And in order to do that, every individual had to be educated.
Re-educated.
Re-educated and empowered to do the revolution upon China.
Mm-hmm.
Which usually was people under 30, right? People in their teenagers.
Yeah, the next generation
who has not
gone through the first revolution has got to be brought on board.
People who had no experience with the prior world, who were fresh, weren't tainted by it. And obviously, if you've seen any of other episodes, it was terrible and traumatizing. Millions and millions of people were killed. There was all sorts of schemes that went on, industrial schemes, social schemes, political schemes, that all essentially failed. And it almost destroyed China.
Yeah. The first 30 years of People's Republic of China.
Yes.
We're talking about. Yeah.
But part of that, though, is that they felt like they needed to educate people and they needed to teach people things. And this goes way back since the beginning of the revolution. The Communist Party and the PLA in China was big on entertainment. Entertainment was always...
Wait, contrary to common belief.
Yeah, contrary... You might think communists aren't fun, right?
It's all boring and gray.
It's all boring and meetings.
But that's Soviet style.
That's Soviet style.
It's not Mao style.
And that's maybe Xi Jinping style.
But, yeah.
But Mao's communism, it's like Soviet communism is like old school Republican Party, right?
Yeah.
In the United States, old school conservatives. Mao is like Trump. Mao's like, we're going to have rallies.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to make jokes.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have fun.
Yeah.
You know,
one of my favorite West Wing lines.
What's that?
How do you think communists got everyone to be communists?
Yeah. Right. But, you know, Mao had some good lines and he understood the power of entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And everywhere the Red Army went, there were performing units. There were singers. There were actors. There were troops. They put on plays. When you started a revolutionary cadre somewhere in some village, just as much as guns, you know, they needed pamphlets, they needed scripts.
Yeah.
Because rural China was a very boring place and there wasn't much to do. And
some people might disagree with
that. I think
countryside in general, especially at the time where material goods, well, you know, economy was not so developed.
Yes.
But
I would argue that they got results, right?
Mm-hmm.
They would put on these shows, they would put on these plays. And people would come to see them and absorb the political messages from them because they were entertainment, right? And
it was a source of entertainment in their hardworking days.
Yeah, possibly dreary lives. So I have a quote here from Red Star Over China by Edgar Snow, which is...
My favorite book.
Okay.
I'm being sarcastic. I hate the book.
Well, I want to do a discussion on it because Red Star Over China was basically an American journalist went to China in the 1930s when Mao was on the run.
Yeah.
And he snuck in past the anti-communist forces and he met Mao. He met the people. He heard his story. And he was very positive about Mao.
Mm-hmm. He was very impressed.
He's very impressed by Mao. And that book set off a whole generation of people who...
That was a very excellent propaganda piece. Like, in modern times, this book is also being used as a propaganda piece.
Mm.
As a proof of how Mao style or Chinese style communism
is
very influential and great.
Yeah, and... because Edgar Snowsey, yeah, very positive about it. And one of the things he writes about is these Chinese performing arts troops. And this is a bit of a summary, but these are a couple lines from it. There was no more powerful weapon of propaganda in the communist movement than the Reds' dramatic troops, and none more subtly manipulated. When the Reds occupied new areas, it was the Red Theater that calmed the fears of the people, gave them rudimentary ideas of the Red program, and dispensed great quantities of revolutionary thought to win the people's confidence. During the 1935 Shanxi expedition, for example, hundreds of peasants heard about the Red players with the army and flocked to see them. So, you know, they understand that, you know, the KMT, they're just trying to rule, right?
Yeah.
They don't necessarily need to get the peasants on board with any sort of ideological program. But as the communists... You know, they don't just need subjects, at least at this point. They need fervent people, right?
They need comrades.
They need comrades. They need soldiers. They need revolutionaries. So you have to get the message out. And how you do that is you entertain people. And then they absorb the message through the entertainment. So that went on. And, you know, I continued basically. I mean, even to this day, right? China has lots of state media. Lots of state-sponsored entertainment and programs and stuff.
Yeah.
But in the Cultural Revolution, you know, they're trying to get rid of everything old in China and replace it with new revolutionary things. So, for example, you know, we talked about they burned lots of old scrolls and books. They smashed temples. They smashed pots.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, broke all these things.
Yeah.
And one of the things on the target list was Beijing Opera, which... Yeah. You know, is very old art, fancy costumes, lots of singing and high-pitched voices.
Lots of screeching.
Screeching.
I can say that I'm Chinese.
Lots of cymbals and bells. And
I think Beijing Opera is pretty famous.
Yeah,
worldwide.
Right. It's pretty unique. But what they thought during the Cultural Revolution was, okay, well, maybe instead of just getting rid of the Beijing Opera, we can turn it into a tool for communism. And the person who spearheaded this was Jiang Qing, who was Mao's wife, who was an actress in her youth, was big into arts, thought of herself as an artist. And so she took it upon herself to essentially sponsor the creation of what were the 8 model plays or the 8 model operas, which were 8 revolutionary stories told in the format of a Beijing opera.
Were they all Beijing operas? Or some of them were just stage plays?
I think some of them were just stage plays. Mm. And also apparently the more popular ones. So this is something I don't know this much about. But apparently along with Beijing operas, other regions of China have their own similar theatrical things that are similar.
There are different styles of plays.
Different styles of operas.
Stage arts.
Yes. And they would remake them in the different regions to fit those art types.
Yeah, these official operas are called yangbanxi, which is a thing of its time.
Mm.
And what, you know...
Revolutionary operas, basically.
Yes, exactly. And what was... direct translation would be like sample plays.
Mm.
And that was sort of the only thing that was allowed to be... to go around, to be performed around the country, to be spread around the country at the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there were, after the revolution, you know, people, with the benefit of hindsight... People think that, you know, everything Mao took over, everything in China was suddenly locked down and communist, which isn't really true. Things like Beijing opera and plays and things we would consider as bourgeoisie went on in China after the revolution.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't until the Cultural Revolution that everything
Why he needed a Cultural Revolution.
Yeah, that's why he needed the Cultural Revolution.
It wasn't permanent.
No. Because people like entertainment, right?
Bread and circuses.
Yeah, bread and circuses.
There was a lack of bread to go around during those years. So you got to have the circuses.
You got to have the circuses. The Great Leap Forward is happening. So
you
got to make up for not enough bread. But taking Tiger Mountain by strategy, we'll talk more about where it came from at the end. It was based off of a book written by a guy who was a soldier the People's Liberation Army.
Yeah.
Time went on, and they decided to use it as one of these stories. And it was a play first, or, you know, Beijing Opera first, and then they filmed it. So we'll talk a little bit about the plot, and we're going to talk about, I guess, our impressions of what this is supposed to teach people. Because beyond just being a piece of entertainment, this is supposed to go out. Beyond the movie version, there would have been local productions of this everywhere in China.
Yeah.
You would have schools do it. You would have party cadres do it. There was performing groups in the People's Liberation Army.
Yeah.
In a society that did not have widespread, in many areas, electricity. You couldn't have radios.
Mm-hmm.
This was how rural people would get the message.
Yeah, they traveled around and play it out.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so it starts off with a bunch of communists marching in the snow. It's supposed to be set in 1946, so the Japanese have been defeated, and now it's this Chinese Civil War. And it's set in Manchuria.
Northern
China, right? Yeah.
Japanese are gone.
Yeah, Japanese are gone, and it's between these fresh-faced, shining, beaming PLA soldiers.
Yeah.
And the these bandits that are affiliated with the nationalists, the KMT.
Yeah.
It's unclear if they're actually affiliated with the KMT, but
they're loosely affiliated. They're not an official part of it, but I think they were about to become an official part of the KMT military.
Yeah, the KMT is sort of interesting in that if you said you were part of the KMT, for the most part, Chiang Kai-shek was happy to have you.
Yeah.
Right? And if you could control an area and say you're a part of the KMT, he'd rather have that than if you're like a communist. And obviously that caused problems because theoretically he controlled large parts of China, but in reality, a lot of them,
it was a warlord militia sort of a system.
Yeah, and if things were going badly, they would.
Yeah, he was like the king of kings.
Yes.
He wasn't the president.
No. Communist is marching in the snow. And you get right off the bat, and I will admit that, so I don't speak Chinese beyond a couple words. This movie, despite its popularity, it was played, the statistic I saw is an average of 10 times per village per year during the Cultural Revolution.
And there's a lot of villages in China.
A lot of villages. And if you didn't go to these things, then people would suspect that you would have some sort of anti-communist leanings, right?
Yeah,
you weren't enthusiastically going to these things and cheering.
Yeah.
So lots of people went to it.
But we couldn't find an English translation.
But I did find some enterprising, probably communist college professor from the 1970s.
Communist college professors who study communism?
Yeah.
Okay.
Transcribed the play.
Yeah.
So I read the script and I watched the play at the same time. But it's very political. And so they stop in the snow. And this is an example of some of the dialogue. So the regiment party committee sent us as a pursuit detachment into the snowy forest in accordance with Chairman's Mao directive. Build stable base areas in the northeast. Our job is to arouse the masses in the Mutongchang area, wipe out the bandits, consolidate the rear, coordinate with our field army, and smash the US-backed Kuomintang attacks. It's a task of great strategic importance. That vulture, who's the villain, the bandit, and his diehards gang have hidden themselves deep in the mountains. We've been trudging through the snow for days, but there's no sign of them. We must display our style of continuous fighting. Be resolute, fear no sacrifice, and surmount every difficulty to win victory.
Mm.
So obviously that's straight out of a political pamphlet.
Yeah, of course. And this was adapted from a book,
mm-hmm.
but the script that you are reading is going to be edited many, many times to have a very focused political message.
Yes.
Yeah.
So because they know every single person in China is going to hear these words.
Yeah. So it better be the real correct, sharp and the correct version of Mao's words.
Yes.
Right? And there is a Chinese version. The play itself mm-hmm. is on YouTube. And I think it's been many years. And I don't know about copyrights.
It's probably
stuff,
not copyright.
But yeah, if you know Chinese, I would recommend go on YouTube and search for it. It's very entertaining to watch.
And you do get the impression a bit that it's sort of like eat your dinner and then you get your dessert.
Yeah. Okay.
There's periods of long monologue.
Oh,
where they explain the communist policies. And then they do some singing and some dancing.
Yeah.
And maybe some fighting.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to sit through that.
Yeah.
For example, the last, we'll talk about it, but the last like 10 minutes of the movie is one long dance fight scene, which is probably the part people like the most.
Yeah, maybe, yeah,
probably. And, but that's at the very end, so you got to sit through all the propaganda.
Yeah.
So we have all these little hero communist soldiers. They're here right in the snow to save China, to fight the vulture. So we meet the bandits, who are the KMT, and their costume design is they look like they're like orcs in the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
They have like blue lights shining on them.
Mm-hmm.
They're all raggedy. They have like hair glued all over their faces, like yeah. they're demons or something.
Yeah.
And there's some sort of map they're looking for that will let them take over the region. It doesn't really make sense. There's some map they're looking for. It doesn't really matter what the map's for.
Yeah.
And they talk about how the Americans are helping Chiang Kai-shek. And once communism is defeated, the vulture is going to rule all of northern China.
As the warlord.
As the warlord.
The local warlord mm-hmm. that's working with KMT.
Yeah. They go to terrorize a local village. And even the bandit leader, the vulture's followers are like, maybe we shouldn't terrorize that village. We're right next to it. We want them to like us. And he's mm-hmm. like, no, we're going to terrorize every village. And they go and they like kidnap people to work for them. The bandits kill some people. They grab this lady's baby and dramatically throw it off a cliff yeah. for apparently no reason.
Yeah.
Which actually seems to be a trend in Chinese stories, throwing babies off things. Liu Bei does it. I think I've seen it a couple of Chinese stories, people dramatically throwing babies off things.
It's a grand gesture.
Yeah, Liu Bei is the...
Liu
Bei is the kind of like...
I guess, of the Three Kingdoms, leader of the Three
hero
Kingdoms.
Hero characters in Three Kingdoms.
Yeah.
Romance of the Three Kingdoms. And he really launches that baby. And then, you know, we get some songs. People get killed in the village about how tough their life is under these bandits and how China is a terrible place. So then the next scene is we meet some hunters in the mountains. They're getting ready to escape the area, presumably because of bandits. One is this older guy, another is this young girl in disguise as a man, presumably because she's afraid of being assaulted by bandits.
These bandits.
By these bandits.
These bandits are all things evil.
Yes, all things evil. They're the plague of China.
Yeah.
So then the PLA soldiers, the scouts, approach them, and they're initially afraid. Because they go, these are more bandits.
Yeah.
Right? And then in rather direct terms, the PLA has to like, no, we're the People's Liberation Army. And they're like, sure you are. You know, whatever.
Can just say it.
Yeah. You're very dismissive of yeah. it. They're like, everybody, you know.
They're distrust. They yes. distrust. They distrust, like, you know, any sort of military forces or,
yes.
or people of power.
Men with guns marching around.
Yeah.
And... they talk about how sometimes bandits will claim their People's Liberation Army soldiers.
Yeah.
And I think that is a sort of a defense of... So, I mean, there was lots of communist bandits in China, right? The line between a communist revolutionary in the early days
yeah.
and a bandit is...
was very blurry.
Was very blurry, right?
Also, at this time,
yeah.
China's official government was the KMT.
Yes.
The People's Liberation Army.
So by one definition...
they call themselves that...
they're all bandits.
Yeah, 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 yeah. They're the rebel forces.
Yes.
Officially speaking.
Even now, if you... So, for example, there is some sort of database, I forget what it is, of all of the... martyrs of the revolution or whatever in China, all mm-hmm. all the people who were in the PLA or supposedly fought for it. And if you challenge if any of these people were actually bandits,
yeah,
right, then you basically get...
oh boy, are we gonna talk about that in a second?
Well,
I have a surprise for you.
Okay,
exactly. That
yeah, right. So if you talk,
so keep listening.
Yeah. So if you you know, say like if any of these people were not actually pure communist crusaders who mm-hmm. followed Mao's three principles and never
from the very beginning
took
of
anything
days.
From any peasants, you know, or ever did anything bad.
Yeah.
You basically get blackballed by mm-hmm. by the government. But anyway, so but no, those people are all fake PLA. Anybody who you thought was a bandit was fake
yeah.
PLA. So anyway, the PLA says, you know, they need their help, how great Mao is, how we're different, we're the real communists, you can trust us, we're gonna make your lives better. But these people, these hunters in the mountains, they've been burned too many times.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, we can't trust you. But eventually, the hero, whose name is Yang, he essentially radicalizes them.
Yeah.
You know, like it almost makes me think of, you know, like a cult or a terrorist organization, right? You radicalize them And now they're, by the end of the conversation, they're essentially ready to die for communism.
Yeah, I think radicalized is the right word.
Right, because you need...
It doesn't have to be a negative thing, or not in this case, a positive thing either. Well,
it's a positive thing in general, a negative thing in general. It's shown as a positive thing within the context of the movie.
Oh, yeah, no, that's what I meant. And the movie does show, the play does go into detail, and it's very in line with what I've learned throughout the years in school and I've seen on screen in China.
The official line of how
how they supposedly convince these very distrusting, suffering people of China, right, who have spent a lifetime in despair. They bring them food. There's always unlimited amount of food to gift to these peasants.
Yes.
I always wonder.
You're not saying this is what they actually did, but this is what taught.
This is what I was taught and exactly what was portrayed in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like line by line.
Yeah.
And they always give bags of like rice, I suppose, like grains to villagers. No idea where they came from because these are
another
soldiers.
Village.
They're not farmers, right? Yeah. So if all of China is in despair... Did you steal that from Shanghai or like, I don't know, you know, who knows, but there's always food to give away. There's always a nurse or a doctor that's with the unit that goes around and treat everyone in the village and cures them all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not saying that didn't happen, you know, military forces have doctors.
Yes.
They could go around and help people, but that's what we do everywhere.
But this is,
And they go into the houses, they clean the houses for them, they do housework, they cook dinners, they just go around and do all these...
menial tasks?
It's like they're campaigning. They're doing grassroots campaigning.
So, but here's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Even if they didn't do that in real life, in a way, this is campaigning, right?
Saying that they did it is campaigning.
This is like... We're proving that we deserve to be in charge of China.
Like, we're saying this is how we want China.
Yes.
And it's 100%...
We deserve it. And by the end, he's like, I'll help you track down some of the bandits.
Yeah.
Right? And they find like the secret map that the vulture's looking for, but it doesn't matter. So so scene four, we go back to the People's Liberation Army headquarters. There's some singing. The leader of the PLA forces, they interrogate one of the bandits, give some more politics. He says... Long ago, Chairman Mao told us the Revolutionary War is a war of the masses. It can be waged only by mobilizing the masses and relying on them. Without the masses, we can't move a step. When you say that, it's sort of like with the benefit of hindsight, if you're some remote village who is being told you're communist now.
Yeah.
Right? You go, oh, well, everybody followed them because Mao said, you know what I mean? It's like, well, they wouldn't have won if everybody wasn't following. So even if you've never seen other parts of China...
Yeah.
You accept that it's true. Like, oh, yeah. I guess everybody else in China.
Yeah. Also, in a way that, because this is during the Cultural Revolution, and this is during the Cultural Revolution, they were telling a story of how the communists had won China.
Yes.
Right? And it, in a way, makes the people in the village watching this feel like they're part of it.
Well, also, because it's the Cultural Revolution, it's like, well, we need to re-win China.
Yeah, we need to re-win. You, one of these people, that were exactly what we're talking about in this movie.
Yes.
You are part of the movement.
Yes. And even though you might have missed the original movement.
Because you were born too late. Yeah.
Now you can be part of
this one.
Now
it's your opportunity.
To go...
to save China yet again.
To go beat a factory owner to death.
Yeah, right.
So they interrogate Luan Ping, who's the former bandit leader. And again, the bandits have this weird mix of costumes. Where they're... it's like... some of them are dressed like KMT. Some of them are dressed almost like Japanese or fascists.
Yeah.
Some of them are dressed like imperial officials.
I think the idea is that they took these, like these are a
stereotypes,
a motley crew of people.
Everything that's bad about China.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then these are the vultures, henchmen.
Yeah.
So he's all hunched over. He tries to fool him about the map, which again I don't understand the map. But so, and they basically almost do a struggle session with him. And a struggle session is during the Cultural Revolution where you bring somebody in. And you accuse them of being anti-revolutionary, either because, you know, their parents were landlords, they studied at a foreign school, whatever, they didn't clap enough during Chairman Mao's speech.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically you hit them and you make them keep accusing, and you'll feel better if you confess. And you know,
it's a public torture.
Public torture. People would die during these. They have to wear boards. But anyway, so they interrogate him and they keep telling him to confess. He says, leniency to those who confess, severity to those who resist. And eventually, Luang Ping tells them about what the map is for. They're trying to decide what to do about Tiger Mountain, how to attack it. And I guess the map has positions on it or something that's important. But they go, we could just take Tiger Mountain. We could just attack it because we're stronger than they are. Because we're obviously the PLA and we're so strong. But we're not going to do that because we're too strong. And if you try and punch a fly, the fly will fly away. So we need to take it
They'll just escape.
They'll just escape. So we need to take it by strategy.
It does make sense from the movie plot perspective, because the vulture leader was known to be elusive. No, it is. They made a point that tunnels. He was very elusive. He has all these tunnels. Yes. He can just escape. And then once you leave, they will just come back. And you know, so you got to get them.
So we got to get them. So he says, we must remember what Chairman Mao tells us. Strategically, we should despise our enemy, but tactically, we should take him seriously.
Yeah.
Comrade Tunhua, please call another democratic meeting of the comrades and talk it over again in the light of the latest developments. This is that famously democratic People's Liberation Army.
One people, one person, one vote. That's how we work.
That's how to this day.
To this day.
Though that is a bit unfair. I mean, I'm sure there was more... lower down decision making in the early days and like the PLA and stuff.
One thing that what you just said,
but at least they're implying there was.
It's a propaganda.
Yes,
but it's the image they're trying to present. But like what you said though, like every 10 minutes through these plot points and scening, it's like there's a timer.
Yeah,
like every 5 to 10 minutes they go, we haven't mentioned Chairman Mao yet,
and we got to talk about
how we got to talk about him again. Yes.
The plan is they decide to send Yang, who's kind of the hero, to infiltrate the bandits, which I guess he's done before. And because he's a peasant and he's from sort of the region, he understands how to talk to the bandits.
Yeah.
Though he really is like quite the hero character, as we'll see. It's not really explained why he is quite so adept to sneaking to places. But he's going to sneak in. He's going to convince the bandits he's one of them.
Yeah.
And then he's going to get the defenses of the village.
He's sort of the protagonist of the show.
There's this upcoming event called the 100 Chickens Feast, which is where the bandits have a feast on the vulture's birthday of 100 chickens that they've stolen from 100 different families.
It's not just 100 chickens.
No.
It's 100 chickens from 100 different families because they are exploiting the whole community around them. Everyone is a victim.
And they have to be that cruel.
Yeah.
So they're like, okay, well, that's coming up in the spring. So we'll send him in, he'll get the stuff, and then we'll attack in the spring.
Yeah.
So scene 5, Yang goes to meet with the bandits. He shoots a tiger, does a lot of dancing, and convinces them that he's one of them. The bandits still look like RPG monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Scene 6, Yang goes to the bandit camp. It's like a cave with no lighting.
It's like these people are like bats.
Instead of bats.
Instead of like little militias.
Yeah.
Guerrilla fighters.
Little guerrilla fighters. They're living in this big rock cave and the vulture's sitting on this throne.
Yeah.
And whenever Yang walks around and he's wearing this really sweet like tiger vest.
Yeah. It's a tiger skin vest.
And like this tiger skin hat. I think his boots are tiger skin.
He's all dolled up.
It's quite striking. None of the other bandits look like that. All look like they've been rolling around in the dirt.
No, the bandits don't look like they're rich or anything.
No.
They don't look like they're living their life, exploiting, stealing wealth from all the people around
I think that's the implication of like, they're doing this and they're still miserable, right? Mm. They could just be the PLA. And Yang always has a light on him. He's walking around. So there's all this back and forth. The vulture's sitting on this throne. One small thing is they're talking about how one of the KMT generals is in possession of a Japanese sword given to him by the Japanese.
Mm.
So they're not so subtle implication that the KMT
are in bed with the Japanese. KMTs was the leading.
Once fighting the Japanese.
Yeah. But you know, like all the bad people together again in this camp.
Yes. It's just a group shorthand for everything bad about China, right? All the sufferings of the peasants.
No, all the opposite party.
To communism,
yeah.
So Yang chums it up with the vulture, gives them the secret map, and, you know, is declared like a sworn brother or whatever.
They accept him as one of their own.
One of their own. So we go back to the peasant village from earlier, the one where the guy threw the baby off the cliff. The People's Liberation Army arrives, And again, everyone has been so ravaged by Bannis that they don't trust them.
Yeah.
But like you said, Cherry, they go around, they make soup for people. They, you know,
give you bags of rice.
They, you know, there's medics, and eventually they convince. And this, the guy whose baby got thrown over the cliff and his wife died, he gives this almost like "I Dreamed the Dream" song.
Speech, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where he's like, "I never dreamed this like day would come where there's, you know, good soldiers of China, and they're here, and they're us, right? They're peasants like us, and we're all on the same side." So
yes, well, they do make a point when they go, "Oh, like, don't do all this housework; it's a lot, right?" And they go, "No, no, all of these, all of our soldiers, they all came from like peasant upbringings."
Yes,
they you can trust us.
Yes, we haven't forgotten. I'm sure the KMT came from peasants too, right?
No, yeah,
but you know, they haven't forgotten their class consciousness.
No, are we gonna talk about the train?
Well, yeah, we're going to talk about the train. So, but basically, they radicalize the village like they radicalize the hunters.
You mean they bring them on board to the right side of history.
To the right side of history. They awaken their class consciousness into the spirit of revolution. So they need food and winter clothing, though, because they go, "You guys are too scrawny to fight, right? We have guns, but you guys need food."
Yeah.
So they have this elaborate plan, which is interesting, where they go, "Well, what we'll do is we'll fix the railroad.
We'll
build a railroad to the village.
Mm-hmm.
You'll pick medicinal herbs in the mountains.
Yeah.
Then you'll trade them for food and clothing."
Yeah.
It's all very capitalistic in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that's supposed to represent that, oh, not only are we just soldiers, but we're also bringing civilization to these rural areas. And we're linking them into the economy.
Yeah.
Which we're about to
destroy. They're like the saviors, right? They're communal saviors of these rural villages.
Yes.
And
because it's not just about, if any of you have ever seen the movie Seven Samurai. The whole thing with that movie is, it's a Japanese movie where a village is going to get attacked by bandits. They hire samurai. The samurai train them. They kill the bandits. The samurai leave. But nothing really changes, right? It's just a cyclical thing. And if the bandits come again next year, nothing will change. But the whole point of this is, not only are they going to take out the bandits, but they're going to modernize this village. It's not just that it's going to be free of the threat. It's going to be that it's improved.
What did we say? A permanent revolution? A new China?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the message.
That's the message.
Yeah. Also, there's no mentioning of like any engineers. I don't know where they get steel for the railroad. But they're like, "We're going to build a railroad like in this winter and then in spring." And then later in the movie, the railroad has been built. And it's you know, there's a train, they're trading. It's all very,
it's just that
it's
easy.
All very fairy tale like.
Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, that's the idea. Like you want these people in these poor villages watching to think, "Oh, that could be us."
Yeah, we could have the PLA is going to.
Yeah, as long as we follow the party, this could be us.
Yeah, we're going to be all smiling with bags of rice.
I'm sorry. Yes.
They're all carrying these big bags of rice. It's like, wow.
Everywhere, like, they have these, they're like gift bags.
Yes.
It's ready to be bestowed, like,
the PLA, it's
upon
like
upon the peasants and you know, the farmers who are hungry.
Rice diplomacy.
Exactly.
Yang in scene 8, Yang gets the secret bandit information, but the vulture is suspicious. They won't let him leave. There's this plot point about a vulture does a fake attack to see if Yang will report it, to see if he's a real...
They were kind of suspicious.
But Yang is just so smart that he realizes
it's fake.
Yeah,
he's so good at this. So they believe him at this point. They're like buddies.
He's a trusted person in the bandit camp.
Also, he's a tiger hunter, so they're really...
Yeah,
respect him.
He shot a tiger. Oh, if anybody's watching the scene where he shoots the tiger, which is a little bit earlier, he's doing this whole little dance with a stick, and I read in the script that he was supposed to be riding a horse.
No, he was riding a horse.
And I did not understand. I thought, like, okay, this is a movie. This is
Have
like,
you never seen dances where, like, they pretend, like, in
I just assumed
in musicals.
For the movie version, they could get an actual horse if they wanted to.
I think they were playing this on a sort of a stage because there's, like, stage setup.
Yeah, studio but he has, like, a stick and he's supposed to be on a horse. But anyway, he does a horse dance.
Yeah, he was on a horse.
He's on a horse. So it's spring. The villagers have made money selling herbs. They have food. They have clothing. They're ready to attack Tiger Mountain alongside the PLA. And it's basically everybody in the village. It's the men. It's the women. One thing about this movie is it is very they don't make a big deal about the fact that there's women soldiers in the PLA.
It's just so natural.
And that there's radicalized women soldiers in mm-hmm. the village.
Yeah.
Who've been radicalized by the PLA. Well,
the woman, the teenage girl we were talking about.
Who was hiding her identity before.
Yeah, as a boy. Mm-hmm. She completely transforms yes. into this blossoming young woman who is ready to become a comrade.
Well, she is
who is a comrade.
Yeah.
Who's became a comrade.
Who in the final act yeah. is gonna charge into the bandit fortress with a bayonet and stab people to death.
Yes.
So,
I mean, you got to get half the population
yeah.
to be on board.
The famous quote from Mao is, women hold up half the sky.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, there were. This isn't an anachronism. I mean, the communists would quite happily give a woman a rifle in a village if she was going to shoot a canteen yeah. for
well,
them.
Well, we talked about this in the marriage episode.
Yeah.
Where sort of as a way to transform a society, but also like to really make a grassroots movement, grassroots,
mm-hmm.
the early stage communism in China really tried to bring women on board.
Yeah.
And they did so by, you know, abolishing like traditional laws of marriage,
mm-hmm.
right? And making sure that fathers pay for childcare mm-hmm. everywhere that communism was at.
And a lot of women also would go into these performing troops.
Yeah.
Right? And spread the communist message that way.
Yeah.
Everyone radicalized. One of the prisoners escapes, the guy who got interrogated at the beginning, to warn the vulture that the communists are about to attack. And he gets there, he realizes that Yang is a communist, and he tries to convince them, but Yang's, again, too smart.
Yeah.
And he convinces the vulture that Wan Ping...
The real bandit.
The real bandit is the traitor.
Yeah.
And then Yang just takes him outside and shoots him in cold blood, which is kind of interesting.
I mean,
yeah,
there is no trial.
Yeah, there is no trial.
In the times of communism revolution.
Yeah, right? He's a landlord. He's a bandit.
Yeah.
They gave him one chance, Cherry. He ran away. So yeah. He lost
his
chance.
So he deserves to die in this case.
So Yang takes him off scene and shoots him. Then the communists sneak in without ever getting the map. So they basically follow... They follow.
I mean, they got the map. They got the map. There's a plot that got the map.
Where'd they get the map from?
They got the map from the guy. That's why he brought the map. Yang brought the map to the. Well, how do you think Yang got the map?
Yang brought the map to the bandits.
Yeah, but they copied the map before Yang bring the map. They made up their. Okay, you need to read this.
Okay, well, whatever. But
delete that part.
But no, I'm not deleting that.
That's factually wrong.
That's fine. But what they do though is they follow the tracks of the guy who escaped. Through the snow.
Sure, yeah.
To figure out how he got in.
Yeah.
And then, because he knows the back entrances or whatever. But anyway, so they sneak in. There's this really long fight scene, which is actually pretty good. And
some good action.
Some good action. Lots of sword fights and bayonets and shooting people. And then they kill everybody. And then they all come together and they pose. And the movie ends.
Yeah.
So a little abruptly, right?
A quick ending, I would say.
A quick ending. So... That's the plot, and as you can see, you know, it's nothing earth-shattering there. It's fairly simple because again, this is for the common people of China to digest, right? It's not supposed to be a
philosophical
work, right?
It's not asking any philosophical questions.
No, it's not asking any questions.
Oh, yeah,
it's answering your questions, which is
yes.
Who are these communists? Why do they think they're in charge? Why should I listen to them? You know, and, you know.
What does it mean to me,
how
this
is
movement?
This, yeah, how is it different than just having an emperor?
Yeah.
Or the KMT.
Yes.
And so this is explaining it to them. And this is not obviously the first movie like it. These plays, things like it, dances, songs, you know, went back, like we talked about, to the beginning of the revolution. But this is...
This is
the most famous one because this is at the point where the communists control everything. They have mass media, and it was the Cultural Revolution, which is, you know, perhaps the greatest, the cultural high point of communist propaganda. Maoist propaganda in terms of intensity. So, I think Cherry has looked up some background.
Yeah.
To it.
Well, there's a lot of. Even today in China, in the Chinese world, there's mm-hmm. a lot of material about this, right? Because it is a cultural phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
judged based on how prominent it was only like 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But throughout researching, there's three people's fate. There are three people who sort of jumped out.
Well, and yeah, one, So we talked about Breaking with Old Ideas.
Yeah.
Which is much more, which is an actual movie. This isn't really an actual movie. This is somebody filmed a stage production.
Yeah.
With a little, some special effects. And Breaking with Old Ideas is an actual movie. And I think Breaking Ideas is more entertaining. But in the same way, it did not have the cultural impact of this.
No.
I think probably very few people, even in China, have probably seen Breaking with Old Ideas.
Yeah, it's not a household
known
movie.
This is like,
nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, like, Taking Tiger Mama's Strategy is like Snow White or Cinderella or, you know, Aladdin or Lion King
Disney
or something.
Movie it's a Disney movie. Of the Cultural Revolution times.
Everybody sung the songs. Everybody knew it. You know, everybody knew the characters. They could do the dances. So there's a lot more known.
I don't know if everyone could do the dances.
You know what I mean. But there's a lot more known about it and the people involved than Breaking with Old Ideas.
Yes.
So.
Well, so there are three people. Their fate is tied to this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Or this story, really, right? This piece of work. Art.
Yeah.
This piece of art. Propaganda art. So the, like you mentioned, it was a story adapted from the fictional novel called Tracks in the Snowy Forest. In Chinese, it's called Ling Hai Xue Yuan. And it's written by Chinese writer Qu Bo. And this was his favorite book. But it got instantly pretty popular in China. And he wrote it in, I think, 1955. And, you know, it was right after New China had been established. This book, with stories like Taking of the Tiger Mountain, really portrays the POA in a very positive light, right?
Yeah.
It's a great propaganda piece for them, a great propaganda for them. So a little bit about the writer, to put things into perspective.
I want to actually say briefly is like, and I think one reason why this is interesting, and again, why all these things have to venerate the PLA, is in traditional Chinese Confucian culture, soldiering is not viewed as an honorable profession.
Yeah, scholars are.
Scholars are, and even farmers are viewed higher
than,
because you're creating something, right? You're creating a thing. Merchants are usually below farmers because they don't create anything by that mind. They just trade.
Yeah.
And soldiers are like the worst because they just kill people. And, you know, that mentality of like, you only be a soldier if you have to be, if somebody kidnaps you and drags you into a unit.
Yeah.
I think was still around with like the KMT, and in your villages and stuff, you have to show that no, these aren't thugs. These aren't bandits.
They're revolutionaries.
They're revolutionaries. They're comrades. They're peasants. They're peasants with guns, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They have all the virtues of a peasant, but
they're helping us to take our fate upon ourselves. Yeah.
Mm.
So he was one of those soldiers. He grew up in a village, you know, in the countryside. He joined. Back then, it was called the 8th Root Army because it wasn't official then. They haven't taken China.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he joined the POA basically when he was 15 years old. And he fought against the Japanese invasion as part of the army. He fought in the Chinese Civil War. And he specifically fought in the northeast region of China where the story happened. So this book was sort of based on his real life experiences. And he obviously adapted into a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And after 1949, he became a party official, right? So he spent his life in the military and the party.
Yeah.
And, but looking at his life, you would think he's a model citizen of China.
Yes.
Of New China. However, his times as a party official wasn't all that smooth. Wasn't like his times in the military. I mean, he was injured in the military, but, you know, he had a pretty good, successful career.
Well, in the war chair, you only have to worry about people on the other side stabbing you.
Right, exactly.
So, you don't have to worry about getting stabbed in the back.
Yes. So in 1955, he was working in a car factory as a party secretary.
Mm-hmm.
He was criticized for being against implementing of the system of one-man leadership, which is a model from Soviet Union, apparently, from the time, meaning that, you know, in a car factory, there's one person, likely either the party secretary or the factory manager, who's going to be responsible for everything.
Instead
Just
of,
like in China, Mao would be responsible for everything.
Instead of having what, like a committee?
I don't know, union, maybe?
Okay.
Yeah, so he didn't like that. And he was criticized as being like on the right.
Presumably by other people in the party.
Yeah.
The workers were probably like, yeah, great, let us decide to do
something. Yeah, but you know, workers don't have... I mean, we say that they have the voice, but
yeah,
try to organize a union in China today.
Mm-hmm.
See where you.
So this guy's
so
a
see
true,
how far you can get.
So this guy's a true believer.
He will be one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
And later on, he was reassigned to a different factory. It's a steel rolling mill in Sichuan province. And during the Big Leap Forward, the local government requested steel and other production materials from the factory that he managed. And he said, no, this is for the factory and everything needs to be accounted for. It's all on the books.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was, of course, criticized in the anti-rightist campaign in 1959 for sabotaging the Great Leap Forward movement. That's a big hat to wear.
Well, you know what's interesting, though? I think some of the people who do get caught up in this, they are the most... They are some of the people with the best records because they think like, no, I don't have anything to hide. Of course I'm not a rightist, right? I fought in the revolution.
No,
I'm just going to be honest.
Yeah. And the thing about Great Leap Forward, it's not based on honesty or facts or reasonable expectations or real production results.
Yeah.
So anyone who believes in those stuff, which, you know, ideally you do if you manage a factory.
It's basically an entire economy just lying and hoping they're not the ones who get
getting the shit
caught up in the lie. Yeah.
Yeah. Then people high up, because this is like the second time, probably there's some smaller times, you know, that had happened in between, but you know, this is not the first time he has gotten into trouble. So people high up in Beijing had heard of this and they said, you know what, he's written some good stuff for the military, you know, and he's a good old party man, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, let's move him back. You know, he will stop making him to go to factories and get criticized for being like the rightist and doing things the wrong way.
We'll keep him out of trouble.
Yeah. So they got him a job at the Central Political and Cultural Department in Beijing, and his job was just, you know, write.
Okay.
He became a writer for the party, right? Couldn't get into much more trouble after that, you would think. There comes the Cultural Revolution. I'm sorry, because every episode we do about this history period,
then like, comes the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah, because you follow everyone's fate, right? Yeah. And you see how they've done throughout first Great Leap Forward, and then the rightist campaign, and then the Cultural Revolution.
It's the very definition of the nail that sticks up gets hammered down. And that, like, if you are notable enough to be noticed, you're a target in the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah.
Right? Even if you've only done good stuff.
Yes. So he had four big hats on, which every anti-revolutionary during the Cultural Revolution did. And he was a capitalist roader, a revisionist. He was a participant in literacy and artistic reactionary line, which was a thing that I could not even understand in Chinese. But basically, it's to say like people who work in literacy in an artistic field.
Yeah.
An actor, if Ma's wife hated her, if she's younger and prettier. I am a feminist, by the way. This is not me like trashing woman, but...
I mean, Mao's wife was not a great person.
Yeah.
Women can be not
great. For another whole episode. Yeah.
You can be a woman and also be a not great person.
Yeah. And so, but basically this is the group of people like who working like writers, performers, artists, work, you know, artists who are not necessarily intellectuals. Yeah. Who are not necessarily who are anti-revolutionary.
Yeah. So by some definition,
by whatever definition it is. He was also one of the cow demons and snake spirits. So this is an old Chinese saying. It's basically saying like Satanist monsters, devils. Okay. Like in the Chinese sense.
So wait, saying like he's like a wizard?
He's cow demons and snake spirits. So like niu gui shi shen, like sure, a wizard. You have some weird magical evil power.
Okay, wow. Yeah,
but like that's how you brand people in Cultural Revolution. It's very dehumanizing, which is the point. And so at this time, though, he also just finished a book right before the Cultural Revolution. It was about to be published. The book called Qiao Long Biao. The name of the main character. It's a tale of a patriotic hero, basically like a local bandit, who's very legendary, who's very good at fighting, who didn't want to be affiliated with anything. So he wasn't on the communist side, he wasn't on the KMT side. But he later on, throughout much struggles and a lot of legends, he was later enlisted into the communist forces during the war against Japanese, but not after some struggles.
Mm.
And this was seen as a big poisonous weed, apparently, because, you know, if we have a story where there's a hero character who is not one of the party members, who was not part of the POA.
Yeah, because the whole idea of these stories is that once you are presented with the actual communism, right, with the actual Maoism. Once the PLA arrives in your village, once they explain it to you, you either are one of two things. You either wholeheartedly accept it and believe it immediately.
Yeah.
And are absorbed into it.
Yeah.
Or if you have any reservations at all, you're anti-revolutionary. Yes. And you're a reactionary. You can't be a positive person.
No, there's no gray area.
There's no gray area, right?
Yeah. So how dare you tell a story about this?
Yeah.
So that was bad news. And, you know, it was going to get published. It was printed.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, no. So it was canned and it wasn't published until like 10 or so years after. Anyways, during Cultural Revolution, he was in jail at one point.
Mm-hmm.
He was assigned a job as a janitor at one point. And later on, because he had disabilities during the war, like he couldn't walk right because of injuries from the war, he was allowed to work in a communion kitchen, which was a big mercy.
Yeah.
That they had, you know. Yeah. So that's his fate. And later on, during the Cultural, when they decided, okay, you know what? This is a really... a good piece of propaganda. They took him out of jail to work on this.
On the screenplay. For the movie.
Yeah. And the second person whose fate also is tied to this movie,
mm-hmm,
is the actor who played the main protagonist, Yang Zerong, of the movie. You know, the guy who...
sneaks into the bandit camp, wears his little tiger outfit.
Yes.
Does lots of sword fighting and dancing.
Right? Yeah. So he was played by actor Tong Xiangling, who grew up in a family of Beijing opera performers.
Mm-mm-mm.
And he was very famous because he was very
bad
good.
Bad revolutionary pedigree right there. I know. There.
He was one of the top performers at the time. And of course, that also means he's anti-revolutionary when Cultural Revolution comes around the corner.
Well, yeah, he's an artist in a reactionary form of media, Cherry.
Yes, right? So he got the job first to play this character. However, they took the job back because, you know, he has bad records.
Yeah.
You know, he's anti-revolutionary. How could you do that? Mm-hmm. How could you have him play it? Play a hero.
Why don't we have a peasant do it?
Right? And then they couldn't find anyone good to play it. Because you know what? Beijing opera, traditional Chinese art, not that big of a field of talents. You know what I mean?
And also, like, you know, it requires a lot of practice, right? I mean, the Cultural Revolution,
mm-hmm,
everything was like happening. I'm snapping my fingers, but everything was happening like so quickly.
Yeah.
So it's not like, well, it's not like you can just train somebody for 2 years to learn the role.
No,
right?
You can't train anyone for Beijing opera for 2 years.
I know. So it's
like making sushi rice.
Oh, yeah. But you know what I mean? Even to have somebody be bad at it, right? You need. So, and if you watch the movie, you know, some of these cuts, you know, it's like 10 or 15 minutes of dancing and singing and stuff, right? It's not, it's not simple.
Oh, those are professionals.
Yes.
The propaganda aside,
yes,
there was a lot of decent performing.
Yes.
In the movie. And you really need to be able to sing.
It'd be like if you were trying to put on a production of, you know, like Cats or something, you know, I don't know, Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, you're just grabbing random people.
Yeah, can't do that.
Yeah.
Also, most Beijing opera performers at this time are probably anti-revolutionary. So it's not like they have a pool of peasant performers to choose from.
Yeah.
So anyways, they couldn't find anyone good. And also you need someone young of a specific look. This is the protagonist of the movie. So they called him back and told him that this would be an opportunity for him to redeem himself playing this role. So of course he took the job, right? Otherwise he was probably in jail or getting struggle session every day. I don't know. So during the shooting of the movie, he was routinely hazed in many scenes where he's the only one who does the singing, which he does most of the singing in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
They would reshoot it again and again and again until he like just so tired and out of it. And he's the only one doing all the singing. And he had, besides playing the main character, being the star of the show, he had to do dishes of every meal of everyone on set. And there's more than 200 people. So he wrote in his, like, he later wrote a book, of course, after the Cultural Revolution, detailing his experience making this movie. And he was, after every breakfast, lunch, and dinner, he had to do more than 200 people's dishes. And then he go act, and then he go back and do the dishes again. So that was his life.
Yeah, well, he had to do that if he didn't want to get killed, probably. So
right,
making this movie. I mean, even then, though, right? I mean, he by many people in the Cultural Revolution, he got off easy.
Oh yeah, I mean, okay. When I say like, okay, I made it sound like the worst thing in the world to do dishes. I mean, a restaurant worker can do 600 people's dishes a day, right?
Yes.
It's not literally torturing.
Yes,
it's not physical like torturing. in a sense.
Yes.
But
it's very petty.
It's very petty, but B, considering they also hate him during the shooting,
mm-hmm.
it was probably not a good experience.
And they need him.
He doesn't. They don't need him. He needs them. He needs to redeem himself.
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
I forgot about that. Sure.
Yes. So while we're entertained, while we're being entertained by this movie and all of these people who are watching it, right? Like no one's watching it today, but
mm-hmm.
people who were watching it everywhere in China at the time. And it's so dehumanizing.
This, in a way, is being used for something that the end result is bad. You have
Cultural Revolution, yes.
Yeah, Great Leap Forward, Cultural Revolution, communist oppression, all these things. But the interesting thing is about it, though, is the actual content of the propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
There's not really much objectionable about it.
No.
Right? Yeah, just, we're building railroads. We're improving people's lives. We're fighting bandits who are stealing 100 chickens from every family, right? We're feeding people. We're doing all these things.
And let's forget about the fact that just about 15, 18 years ago, thousands and thousands of people who died
Mao doesn't know how to organize an economy. So it is very, you have to keep in context of this. It's so positive,
mm-hmm.
and so, I guess, wholesome in a way.
Yeah.
Although Yang executes that guy in Cold Blood for something that was...
That's wholesome by communist standards.
Well, for something that was made in support of a regime that crushed so many people, and even the people making it, the guy who wrote the book,
yeah.
life was destroyed. The actor, right? His life was destroyed
yeah.
by the Cultural Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So it's strange that you get such a positive thing
also,
out of so much misery.
The story itself, the book itself, was not about the Cultural Revolution.
No,
it was about the Chinese Civil War. It was
yes.
about two different visions of China.
Yeah.
And like we said, he's, there were true believers who believed that communism was the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's realistic or not, but it was the sort of the fight between like a nationalist bourgeoisie, like city elites, right? Who fights against peasants. That's
yeah.
sort of what a lot of these people were fighting for.
Mm-hmm.
And
they didn't want,
he wanted a factory where everything's on the books
yeah.
instead of the Great Leap Forward. Right?
Yeah, he didn't want the guy who wrote the book, The Tracks on Snow or whatever.
Yeah.
He didn't want China with another emperor.
No.
Right? He wanted a new society.
Yeah.
And I think it's sad that that's not what he got. And it took him a while to realize that's not what he had, right?
Yes. And so that's, it's a weird situation where a lot of people who did fight for it, and in a way, do you blame them? Do you blame them had, in a way contributed to the Cultural Revolution because they had fought over a new China? A new China came and
yes.
it was not a...
No, when...
It was a dictatorship.
No, when yeah. somebody like, I don't know, Peng Dehuai or somebody or some Chinese general
yeah.
is fighting for the Chinese Civil War, in their mind they're not thinking about like, I'm doing this for the Cultural Revolution that's going to happen in 20 years, I'm doing it for the Great Leap Forward.
Yeah, they
right? they think it's going to be better. They think
yeah.
we're not going to have those kind of mass famines and
yes.
things because we're going to have a better system.
Yes. So
speaking though of modern day of the results.
Yeah, so the third person whose life is, this was a surprise because, I'll get into it. In 2015, a video was leaked in which this famous Chinese TV host, Bi Fujian, was criticizing Chairman Mao.
Making fun of him, basically.
Making fun of Chairman Mao at a banquet table.
Mm-hmm.
And someone shot a video of it. It was about a minute long and it got leaked. It got very trendy on the internet. And... So Bi Fujian, anyone outside China probably won't know him, but he is a household name in China at the time. And he was, he was one of the several hosts of, the Chinese New Year Gala that happens every year that millions and millions of people watch.
Hundreds of millions. Yeah.
And so, his face is on TV every day,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Or it was.
Was his face was on TV every day.
Until he made a joke about Mao.
Until he made a joke about Mao. And, and it was such a big thing, but how he made fun, he mocked Mao, our great Chairman Mao, was that he did a parody of Taking the Tiger Mountains. He sang some lines from it, and in between he dropped in some little snarky comments, right? About how, this wasn't true, or, mm-hmm. we really suffered a lot, And The significance of this is that Bi Fujian, he is like about the age of our parents' generation, the generation that grew up during Cultural Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
The
kids during it.
Yeah, kids during it. Like, you know, like, yeah, kids during it or teenagers during it. So he knew the lines of taking of the Tiger Mountain by heart.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a, like you said, it's like a Disney movie of their generation.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's, you know, the natural sort of familiarity that he had when he sang those lines in the video, it's kind of uncanny.
Yeah.
And this was a big thing in China because instantly he worked for the national TV station, right? They came out, they criticized him. They said this thing has serious social consequences, even though it was a private banquet and it was clearly not broadcasting. He didn't mean for it to be broadcasted anywhere.
He was drinking and he made a joke.
And he was kind of drunk, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, you can't joke about it. Yeah, so this was a big thing in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all over China, New York Times reported it. It was known in the Western world as well.
So I heard about it at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember we talked about it.
We did.
But I didn't. I mean,
I didn't know either.
I didn't know. I hadn't seen Tiger Mountain at that point.
Yeah, what we didn't know was that he used Tiger. He did a parody of Tiger Mountain to mock.
Yeah.
To mock Chairman Mao. So, and this thing really was seen as a sort of a turning point or one of the signals, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese society at that time, 2015, was going sort of backwards.
Mm-hmm.
In terms
not
of,
sure. It's going forward. You saying Xi Jinping thought isn't the future?
I'm making a face because I don't know what to say. No, Mao's thoughts is the future, right?
Okay.
So yeah. So that's, you know, it's just interesting. And I've asked some of my relatives, you know, older relatives, if they had watched, and they go, "Of course I've, of course I've watched. All China has watched it during those years."
But I have not. So you told me that you had seen things.
I know the
that
book.
That are related to it, right?
Yeah, I know of the book because it's adapted in movies when I was growing up, in TV shows when I was growing up.
But you hadn't actually seen.
But I didn't know it was one of the 8 model-like operas.
And you didn't realize it was as popular as it was.
No.
I started reading about it, and I was like, "Cherry, we should watch this." And you're like, "Why do I have to watch this stupid, like, play
propaganda piece. I'm trying to look away."
Yeah, and I was like, "Che, it's the most popular movie."
Well, I was thinking about it, and I think some of my feelings really came towards, because I grew up in 90s China, right? Not to give myself away,
mm-hmm.
My age away, but there was a time where this is not like. Not that we're trying to move on, but like that part of history,
mm-hmm.
about Cultural Revolution, about how it happened, why it happened, what do we think about it? You don't talk about that, right?
Yeah.
China has simply just moved on.
Mm-hmm.
Really, right? Like Tiananmen Square, China has just simply just moved on.
Yeah.
A generation just simply moved on.
Let's just not talk about it.
Let's just not talk about it, which is why like I wasn't. And also like because we have moved on so quickly with the economic growth and all that. And we live in a completely different world, even though now we're going back. But, you know, when, like for a good 20, 30 years, many aspects of the Chinese society, for people who grew up in it, the new generation, you don't get confronted by it at all if you don't go out of your way to look for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I don't know. I mean, like, obviously, some people will say moving on was good. Right. Some people will say, you know, let's just make life better, like Deng Xiaoping said, right?
Yeah.
Like, at least what the propaganda, the party line was. But at the same time, it's like clearly this was part of a generation's memory as the Chinese TV host drunkenly. That's the lines he had chosen. That's the piece of propaganda he had chosen to.
That's what came out when he was drunk, right?
Yeah. My denial.
Yeah.
My feeling of denial came sort of from like my education and the way I was brought up, that and also like just my habit of sort of looking away and not having to confront something.
Hopefully that was interesting to people.
Yeah,
we like talking about media from eras that are kind of alien
historical artifacts. We think they
artifacts
are.
Yeah, let us know what you think, and I hope everyone's doing well, and have a nice
leave us
day.
A review on Apple Podcast if you could,
only if you liked it though.
Oh my god, okay.
If you didn't like it, don't leave us a review.
Still do.
Privately DM us on Twitter and suggest us to improve, and then once we've improved, then leave us a good review.
Okay.
is that too specific of instructions
for people? I don't know if anyone's gonna follow that.
Oh, okay. We'll see. Anyway, thank you for listening. Have a nice day.
See you next time.